team the strength and the show success. All for one and one for all. Unity means solidarity. Yeah. United we stand. Divided we fall.
Ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting edition of the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you by GorillaMedia.co.nz, New Zealand's alternative media. I want to talk about Guerrilla Media for a second. I started it up a couple of years ago, and the guy who helped me start it up got the website up and going, first of all, and just recently he's decided that he doesn't want to be a part of it anymore, which is okay, because in the 2 years that he's been helping me with the Guerrilla Media, he's probably spent, I don't know, something that would have taken me about an hour and a half. So it's all good. I'm currently the webmaster and all of that, and been redesigning it. And if you're a frequenter to GorillaMedia.co.nz, you'll notice that it's been undergoing enormous changes over the past few months. Indeed, it's been increasing in hits somewhat ridiculously beyond my expectations. Also, want to give a shout out to our new contributors. Most notably, Evelyn Gilbert, Traveller Ev is her blogger name on Guerrilla Media, and she has been posting some incredible articles that have been getting definite amounts of reads, and very, very proud to have a big and dedicated activist helping me to get information out to the public, as was the original inception behind Guerrilla Media as a platform for activists to get the word out. And I think that if that's the real point of it, then, well, yeah, you know, there's no need to worry about anything else, quite frankly, because, hey, it's working. Indeed, we have a lot of listeners and visitors from New Zealand, even though this show is broadcasting live in America, and we've got a station in New Zealand and all of that, but it's a global, but, you know, for some reason, Kiwis like Kiwis talking about the stuff that's really going on, which is fantastic, and I'm very appreciative for everybody who visits and, you know, makes the effort. Also, in the news today, The Economist's forecast inflation rise to 5.5%. And they're probably just keeping that down. It's more like 25% or even, you know, a couple of 100%, something along those lines. Because, you know, everybody should be able to notice at this particular juncture in time that prices are going up exponentially. Food packages seem to be having a lot less food in them. Gas prices are skyrocketing. Power prices are going out of control. And it is a combination of factors, a artificial bottleneck to basically screw us all. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on American Freedom Radio. We'll be right back.
Jammin', jammin', and I hope
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y because it is the most important question. There are occasions on this show where we do have to basically get very serious because this world is very serious indeed and it does no justice to the people that live within it to make jokes all the time, and believe me, even I realise that. My very special guest today, remarkably special guest, and I have a list here of about 1,700 adjectives that I could use to describe this very, very special man, but I'll just use his name instead. His name is Muad'Dib, and if you don't know who Muad'Dib is, that's the guy from the book series Dune, which has been adopted as an alias from the filmmaker who made a film called 7-7 Ripple Effect, where it exposes the very, very naughty and nasty things that intelligence agencies and the UK government perpetrated on its own citizens in the tube stations. Complete fraud, false flag terror attack, the UK version of 9/11. 7-7 Ripple Effect filmmaker Muad'Dib, welcome to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
Thank you, Vinnie. It's nice of you to have me on the show.
Well, you know, it needs to be done. And as I said during the break, the show is a platform for those who basically need coverage. Now, of recent times, after your film was made, can you just sort of explain just who you are and what motivated you to make 7-7 Ripple Effect?
Well, I'd studied 9/11 from the day of 9/11. Because I knew on that day, just watching the towers come down, that it was obviously not done by the aeroplanes and that the buildings were brought down by controlled demolition, which was further proved by the demolition of World Trade Center building number 7, the Salomon building, because nothing hit that, and that came down in the afternoon of 9/11. And then I followed that for a number of years just to reinforce what I already knew on that day, but to find out more details about it. And then when, on the 7th of July 2005, a friend of mine in London contacted me and asked me if I knew what was happening in London that day, because I was in Ireland at the time. And I said, no, what's happened? So they said, well, there's been some explosions in London, and it's all over the news. So I turned on the television and started to flip the channels, the news channels, that day to pick up all the information that I could, because each news channel has a different slant on things, and the reporters pick up different points from other reporters. So the only way you can get a general overall picture is to listen to as many of the news reports as you can, and particularly the very first early ones, because generally they get out before the government censors have chance to jump in and start censoring things and then arranging all the news coverage to fit their agenda. And when Peter Power came on, Peter Power Advisor Consultants came on the television later that day saying that he and his company had been running a mock terror training exercise on that day with exactly the same scenario as what actually happened. Then that was a red flag. It was obvious from that point that, like 9/11, it was an inside job, a false flag event. And so I started, with a couple of friends, started to investigate it and looked at all the different media reports that were given out. And we looked at them, studied and analysed them, and saw that there were many contradictions in them. There were many gaps. There were many things that didn't add up, didn't make sense, and started to put it together to get the whole picture of actually what did happen or what we think happened in reality on that day. Same as we didn't believe, you know, and most people who've investigated now don't believe what the government said about 9/11. We realised that the government story on 7/7 was a similar fabrication. and also worked out why they carried out 7-7, for a similar reason why they carried out Bali, which affected a lot of Australians. I don't know if there are any New Zealanders in Bali at that bomb. When that bomb
apparently there were a handful of New Zealanders that were affected by that, and in fact one of my friends, she was in Bali at the time of the bombing, in a bar run by a friend of hers, and they called a big curfew, and so they couldn't leave the bar all night. Mm-hmm. But the bartender was very nice, and he said drinks on the house, and pulled out a bunch of beds and things of that nature for all the bar goers to sleep on the floor. So
it was very hospitable. Wasn't it? Anyway, it was. It's always got a similar agenda. Like 9/11 was an excuse for America to go into Afghanistan, and then of course it morphed into an excuse to go into Iraq, even though Iraq didn't have anything to do with 9/11. Of course, there was the Madrid train bombings as well, which killed I think about 300 people and injured an awful lot more. Trying to persuade the Spanish people to keep their troops fighting with the Coalition of the Willing, as they called it. But it backfired on them because the general election, José María Aznar was voted out, and Zapatero got in, and he decided to pull the Spanish troops out. So that backfired on them. And that was on 3/11, which was actually 911 or 911, 911 days after 9/11. And then
I would have tangled web we weave.
Exactly, yeah. And these people that are behind all this are into numerology and things and rituals and all kinds of silly nonsense, satanic nonsense.
Occult ceremonies and things of that nature.
Exactly, yes. And the same happened in London, because in May of 2005 there was a general election in the United Kingdom. And prior to the general election, there had been over 1 million people demonstrating in the streets of London against the war and wanting the British troops brought home. And as a result of that, at the general election in May of 2005, Tony Blair and his Labour government went from a 300-seat majority to almost being voted out of power. And so they had to find a way to change the British public's mind about the British troops fighting in the Middle East and in Afghanistan. And so they carried out 7-7 in order to do that and blamed it on Muslims, and then said to the British population that it's better for our troops to be over there fighting them over there than for us to be suffering and then fighting over here.
But weren't they already in Iraq at the time of the bombings?
Yes, but the British public had demonstrated in the streets of London and various cities demanding that the British troops be brought back from the Middle East.
Let me see if I've got this straight. The reason why the British government was in a big trouble was because they had troops in Iraq, and the reason why they had troops in Iraq was to prevent attacks from happening in England, and even though they had troops in Iraq, an attack happened in England, so the justification is, let's keep troops in Iraq.
Well, yeah, but not exactly. No, it wasn't. They didn't go into Iraq to stop to stop attacks in the UK. There hadn't been any attacks in the UK. They were in Iraq with America after the oil.
Oh, well, of course. I mean, that's fairly obvious. Yeah. There's no other resource worth stealing over there.
Exactly, yeah, just lots of sand. And
And I don't think they're planning on starting up an enormous glass empire using pristine Iraqi sand. It just doesn't make any sense. The oil pipeline maintenance and all of that sort of stuff. It turns out that a lot of the big three oil companies have been attempting to purchase refineries and oil fields that they don't already currently control to shut them down so that it forces an artificial bottleneck for the current oil prices of the world. So geopolitically, it was a smart move because it allowed these, I wouldn't call them Western, I'd probably just call them satanic oil companies to fulfill even more of their agenda using our people as human shields to do it.
Yeah, yeah. So what happened was that the British people didn't want the British troops fighting in Iraq and dying, of course, and wanted the British troops brought home. So they had to do something to change the British public's mind. The British feeling was so strong about it that Tony Blair's government went from a 300-seat overall majority to almost losing power, almost being voted out of power, which was an incredible swing in the population's opinion. And so they had to do something to change the British public's mind, to allow them to keep the British troops in Iraq, even though the British people hadn't wanted that, in order to fulfill their agenda that you've just been outlining. Because part of it was the fact that they wanted to keep Iraqi oil offline, as you've said, to create a shortage, an artificial shortage of oil, so that they could boost the price of oil and make more money and keep the Iraqi oil in reserve.
Well, and facilitate the deindustrialization of the Western world as well, put people stricken into poverty. It's like we've all kind of grown up with cheap oil, and as soon as you start raising the price on it, you know, people just start becoming destitute. You know, it's just like that.
Yeah, yeah. So they carried out 7/7 in order to fulfil their agenda, to change the British public's mind and to tell the British public, look, we're being attacked over here now. The only way we can prevent more attacks is to bring in new anti-terrorist legislation and to keep the troops fighting them over there so they don't come over here, which was a load of nonsense, of course. And so after investigating all of this for a couple of years, somebody sent me a link to watch a film about 9/11. I'd watched quite a few different things, films about 9/11, but somebody sent me a link to look at a film called 9/11 Ripple Effect. And so I had a look at it, and I was impressed with it in the way that there was no hype. It was very calm, very collected, and just had various experts from various fields of expertise analyzing 9/11 and proving to anybody with an open mind that it wasn't the way that the government had told us, and that it was an inside job. I was so impressed with the film that I asked some friends of mine who were also investigating 7/7 in London, and I said, I think, in fact, it was one of them that had sent me the link to this 9/11 ripple effect. And after I'd watched it, I said, has anybody made a similar film about 7/7? I said, because somebody needs to make a film like 9/11 ripple effect about 7/7 to tell the people the truth that we've discovered. And they said, well, there's a couple of people who've made a couple of films. There was one called Mind the Gap, and another one called Ludicrous Diversion, and I had a look at them. And although they pointed out some of the anomalies in the government story, and some of the things that contradicted the government story, they didn't really go into it properly, and they didn't explain what happened. So I said to these two friends of mine, I said, well, you know, these films are okay, but they don't go far enough. They don't explain for the average man in the street exactly what happened in a way that they can easily understand. And so I said, well, I think what we need to do is that, you know, we need to make this film, or I need to make this film, So that's what I set about doing, and I, they put in some ideas and things about a script. Some of the stuff I had to edit out because they had made wild claims that, well, not so wild, but claims that, you know, could lead to libel actions, stuff like that. So I wrote the script and then narrated the film. They downloaded some of the media articles and things from the internet, and we put the film together there, and I wanted to release it on the 5th of November, and it was all timed to get the film out, and we just managed to do it, and I managed to get it out on the 5th of November and load it up onto the internet. I don't know if you're audience, I understand you've probably got people all over the world listening to this, but I don't know if the people in New Zealand where you're based understand the significance of the 5th of November in the UK.
In the UK, I mean, we're talking about Guy Fawkes, and we have a we have big celebrations here for Guy Fawkes, and I don't know. For some reason, I don't think that New Zealanders or any New Zealander for that matter has the madness, the gall, or the patsy ability of Guy Fawkes to actually blow up our parliament. And that's what I believe Guy Fawkes was, is he was set up.
Yeah, but anyway, they understand the significance of the 5th of November. That's the point I'm making. And that's right. Why I wanted, because the film really, in its content, it is so explosive that it could bring down parliament. So that's why I wanted it out on the 5th of November, and we released it on the 5th of November 2007 onto the internet, and it became instantly very, very popular all over the world, very popular with everybody except the British government, of course. And I had people from all over the world email me and thank me for making the film, and including from the UK, and thanking me for opening their eyes to what was really happening and how evil the British government was. And I had people from Spain, Italy and Germany ask me if I would mind if they translated the film into their languages, and of course I gave them permission to do so. And so it became a hit all over. And it put the British government in a bind, you know, put them in a spot.
We'll get into this more after the break, because we all like to hear in detail about how the British government is squirming when it comes to sending our people overseas to die for oil profits. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Muad'Dib, live from the UK, the maker of 7/7 Ripple Effect, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand, from one of the other slave states of the Commonwealth. My very special guest is Muad'Dib, coming at us live from the UK, the maker of 7/7 Ripple Effect. And we were just kind of cut off from the break. We wanted to talk about what the government's reaction to this film was. Apparently, you sent this film to one of the judges that was presiding over this trial. But, of course, I wanted to sort of outline what trial are they talking about? Because if we're talking about, like, what was it, two bombers, apparently, who supposedly blew themselves up, even though we know that they weren't even on the trains at all, how exactly can they try three dead men?
Well, they weren't trying the dead men, but they tried. There were actually four patsies that they accused of being suicide bombers, but it was impossible for them to have done it, as my film proves. And if your listeners Google the 7/7 Ripple Effect, they'll find it on Google Videos and they'll find it on YouTube, and I hope that they will do that and they will watch it and see that my film proves that these four young men were patsies, they were set up and then they were murdered. But the four young men who were accused of being suicide bombers, backpack suicide bombers, was Mohammed Siddiqui Khan, Shehzad Tanveer, Jermaine Lindsay, and Hasib Hussain. And the government story was that they caught the 7:40 a.m. train from Luton in Bedfordshire to Thames Link, which is in London. It's adjacent to King's Cross mainline station and tube station, which some of your listeners may have heard of. Some, maybe even if they visited London, they may even have been there. But they were supposed to have caught the train from Luton to Thames Link and then gone from Thames Link into King's Cross mainline station and then down into the underground beneath King's Cross and caught these tube trains, three tube trains from there, and detonated backpack bombs and blown the trains up. That was the government story. The only problem with that story is that the 7:40 a.m. train didn't run that day. It was cancelled. They were doing work on the lines, and all the trains that day were delayed by at least 25 or 30 minutes, and they got such a backlog of trains from the delay that they cancelled the 7:40 a.m. train that these alleged four suicide bombers were supposed to have caught. So they couldn't possibly have caught a train that didn't run. And the government story said that they had witnesses on this train that didn't run of these four alleged bombers on this train that didn't run. So that was, you know, it was obvious that was a setup. Because all the trains were delayed, the 7:40 was cancelled, and the following train was also cancelled that day, and we have that officially, and I show that on the film. And so the only train they could have caught would have been after that, and as the trains that left after that, like all the trains, were delayed by 25, 30 minutes, it was absolutely impossible for them to have got to London in time to catch those tube trains that blew up. And so they got to London late. When they got there, they found out that the tube trains had already blown up, the ones that they had been told that they should catch as part of this training exercise. And they smelled a rat, realized that they'd been set up and that they would have been killed. And so their lives were in danger. And so they went to Canary Wharf, which is in the East End of London, and that's where Reuters and all the major newspapers are. And I, you know, I've posited the idea that they went there in order to tell their story to the media before they got killed, before they got captured and killed. They got to Canary Wharf, but they were shot dead in Canary Wharf. Well, how can suicide bombers who are supposed to have blown themselves up on three tube trains then be in Canary Wharf later that morning to get shot? So all of this is in the film. And the film is so popular with everybody, and the government knows that anybody who has an open mind and watches the film knows, after watching the film, knows that that's what really did happen that day. And so the government had to try and do something to discredit my film. And what they did was, or at least this is what I assume the reason that they did what they did, was they arrested three friends of these four alleged suicide bombers and put them on trial for what the charge was, doing hostile reconnaissance. In other words, they were saying that these three young men had been to London prior to the bombings to search out targets and things for the four alleged bombers. And so anyway, they put them on trial. And having made the film 6 months previous to this trial, and they put it on the internet, it was in the public domain. The film was in the public domain for 6 months before these men were put on trial. But in the media reporting on the trial of these three young men, I found out that the prosecutor, on the very first day of the trial, said to the jury that there was absolutely no doubt that Muhammad Siddiqui Khan, Shehzad Tanweer, Jermaine Lindsay and Hasib Hussain had carried out these atrocities in London. And of course that's outrageous, because my film proves that they couldn't have done it. And so there is doubt, and millions of people doubt that the four alleged bombers actually carried it out. Even before I made the film, and since I made the film, and it's gone viral all over the world, millions and millions of people doubt that they carried out these bombings. So the prosecutor was actually lying to the jury and committing perjury. And so I thought, well, you know, this is outrageous. The truth has to get to the jury, has to get to the court. So I sent some copies of my DVD film, 77 Ripley Effect, to the court in order to inform the jury that they were being lied to by the prosecution. And then I found out shortly after that that the judge himself in the case, Justice Gross, although justice is a bit of a misnomer in his case, during jury selection had told the prospective jurors, out of whom he was going to pick 12 for the jury, he told them that, of course, you know that Muhammad Siddiqui Khan, Shehzad Tanweer, Jermaine Lindsay and Hasib Hussain carried out these atrocities. Well, that was outrageous for the jurors to do that, because there's never been any proper public inquiry into who did it. They've never been found guilty in a court of law. And under British law, there's supposed to be a presumption of innocence. You're supposed to be innocent until you are proven guilty and convicted by a jury of your peers. And that had never happened. And these four alleged bombers that couldn't possibly have carried out the alleged attacks, because the train they were supposed to caught didn't run, have been vilified, and they have been victims of trial by media. The media has convicted them and convinced, and of course the media is a government propaganda machine, has convinced the British public that these four young men who are innocent actually carried out these bombings. And so this was going on in the court, and it's outrageous for the judge to do what he did and for the prosecution to do that. So I sent a copy of the DVD to the judge, thinking that, well, if he's an honest and decent man and he sees this film, he will apologise to the jury for having misled them, and he will redirect them as to the reality of the situation, and possibly may even call me as a witness. And to explain the film to the, you know, to the court, to the jury, and all of that, which was perhaps a bit naive of me. And instead, what I was trying to do was I was trying to prevent the government from perverting the course of justice against these three innocent young men. And so it's always the opposite. What happened was that the Crown authorities have accused me of doing what they were doing. They have accused, the charge that I'm facing is attempting to pervert the course of justice, contrary to common law, when I was doing the opposite. I was trying to stop the government from perverting the course of justice, and I was trying to prevent a miscarriage of justice.
In my opinion, the entire justice system is somewhat perverted from the word go regardless.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. But you see, these three young men who couldn't possibly have helped four other young men to do something that those four other young men didn't do in the first place could have spent 20 or 30 years in prison. If the government had managed to convict them of this charge, then they probably got 20 or 30 years in prison for something they couldn't possibly have done. And I couldn't sit back and let that happen, having made the film and knowing what I knew. I couldn't sit back and let that happen to these three innocent young men. And also the fact that I believe that they put them on trial in a desperate attempt to convict them, so that by extension they could say, well, look, these three young men are guilty of helping the other four, so the other four must have been guilty, and that my film was wrong, if you follow what I'm saying.
And so
in a way, I kind of felt responsible as well, because if I hadn't put the film out there, they might not have arrested these three young men. And so, anyway, I got arrested of this charge of attempting to pervert the course of justice contrary to common law, when I was doing exactly the opposite of that. And
that's the world we now live in, is that anybody who tries to get real justice is treated as a criminal, and anybody who tries to be a criminal gets real justice. It's insane.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, everything's backwards. Absolutely. But this charge against me is a very serious charge. You know, most people are probably unaware. I mean, it sounds like nothing really to enter into a cause of justice, that you get a slap wrist or something. But it actually carries a life sentence with a maximum of 20 years. So it's a very serious thing.
And so that's why you, and that's why we've brought you on the show today, because people really need to stand up and give you as much coverage and attention as possible for this, because if they can do this to you, they can do it to anyone. And particularly they'll do it to activists and patriots and people who care about their country. So in my opinion, an attack on one is an attack on all. And that's why people like yourself really do need to get some more coverage, so that it's in the public consciousness, so that people are aware of these gross miscarriages of justice. I mean, not just as an isolated case, but also it ripples, if you'll forgive the pun, to many other cases here in New Zealand. When we had the terror raids on October the 15th, I believe it was, the judgments that 7 out of the 9 issued warrants were ruled to be unlawful, and then the judge who did that, Judge Winkleman, sealed that judgment so that the media were not allowed to report on it. And a friend of mine, Vince Seamer from KiwisFirst.co.nz, the foremost judicial watchdog in New Zealand, reported on this. And then the Solicitor General tried to charge him and get him thrown in jail. And even when another friend of mine, Penny Bright, said the exact same thing on her blog, right in front of the Solicitor General in court as well, and we tried to serve documents on him saying, hey, look, we're guilty too. Please charge me as well. And he just smiled and kept walking very, very quickly. And it just goes to show you that that's the world system that we have now. It's not just a corrupt system in the UK or a perverted justice system in New Zealand. It really is a new world order that we're dealing with here. And I think that all these borders and things that sort of divide us are really just representations of how we feel divided as people, rather than being divided and conquered by the elite.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a terrible problem, and as you say, it is a new their new world order. It's outrageous what they did to those friends of yours and to me, and they will do it to anybody who stands up against them. And of course, a real patriot is someone who defends his country from its government, and that of course is what I'm doing. But anyway. The thing is that this charge is absolutely ludicrous that they brought against me, accusing me of attempting to pervert the course of justice.
What are you attempting to pervert a perverted course of justice? Isn't that hilarious?
Yeah.
You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Muad'Dib, live from the UK, the monarchy, state of oppression. And we'll be right back after this very short break.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone. For the times they are a-changing.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Final segment of the first hour here with Muad'Dib live from the UK. So we're going to have to sort of blitz and squeeze in what important information we can into this final segment. Now, there's a bunch of people called Friends of Muad'Dib, and apparently they've all sent DVDs to the court as well. And interestingly enough, none of those people are being charged with perverting the course of justice, so it makes it very indicative that they are targeting Muad'Dib as a political killing, more or less, in my opinion, and has nothing to do with perverting the course of justice, because after all, the only justice that they have in the court system in our countries, in the Commonwealth anyway, under our vicious dictator, the Queen, Queen Detritus, or whatever her name is now, and their new spawn that are about to have just a lovely, lovely, lavish ceremony, you know, it's about time that we say to these people, look, you're a fraud, and that's what we're going to call you, okay? The gloves have come off, and it seems fairly obvious to me that they feel the same way about us. They know for a fact that we're rising up and getting really angry with them, and so they're moving quickly to suppress their forms of dissent, particularly those that are effective, intelligent, and critical of the government, people like yourself. So I'd love it if you could just explain your need for publicity, and of course the greater ramifications for Commonwealth countries with this trial. Go ahead.
Okay, well, it's obviously, like I said, it's obviously politically motivated charge against me to punish me not for sending the DVDs to the court, but for actually making the film in the first place. And the sending them to the court is just an excuse to try to that they're using to try to punish me. But my line of defence is that I've already in the court. I've already challenged the jurisdiction and the sovereignty of the Crown of Elizabeth because she's a fraud. And I'll give out a URL to a web link. It's http://jahtruth. That's jahtruth.net/britmon.htm. And then there's a hash sign and the word crimes. I'll give that out again. It's http://jahtruth.net/britmon.htm#crimes. And that there you will find the document that I have filed with the court challenging not only the jurisdiction of the Crown, but also her actual sovereignty. And in that document, I have listed the first line of attack is the fact that she was fraudulently, knowingly and willingly fraudulently crowned on a fake coronation stone on the 2nd of June in 1953. So she was never lawfully crowned in the first place. And the second line of attack is that at that coronation, she took a coronation oath with her hand on the Sovereign's Bible, which is a special edition of the Bible, particularly for the Sovereign, for the coronation. Okay, with her hand on the Bible, she swore the coronation oath. She then kissed the Bible and signed the oath in Westminster Abbey. And part of that oath is that she swore to maintain to the utmost of her power to maintain the laws of God. The laws of God, okay, in the book that she swore the oath on, in the law, in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 2, it prohibits mankind from legislating. Okay? Now, all of the New World Order's power comes from their ability that they've deceived people into believing that they have the right to legislate. And of course, what happens is they make up their own legislation to enable themselves to rip everybody else off, make themselves very, very rich, obscenely rich, and in the process make everybody else very poor and drive them into poverty. And then, of course, the poverty creates crime. And then these hypocrites who've stolen billions, put the poor people who are trying to feed their families and stealing. And I'm not condoning the stealing. But they put them in jail for stealing a loaf of bread to feed their family. These people are absolute hypocrites. But I've challenged her jurisdiction and her sovereignty, and I have proved that she has thousands and thousands of times she has broken her coronation oath. The coronation oath is her contract with the British people and with the wider Commonwealth, the people of the Commonwealth. Okay, it's a contract in which she swore to uphold God's law. Now, she has broken that covenant thousands and thousands of times. So she has actually broken the contract. And the first time that she broke that her coronation oath, then, lawfully speaking, she was no longer the monarch with immediate effect, even if she had been crowned lawfully on the real coronation stone, which she was not. So on both of those lines of attack, she is a fraud and a criminal and a traitor. And so I have filed a witness application with the court to have her come to court on the 9th of May this year to my hearing, where I want to cross-examine her and want to prove to the whole world that she's a fraud and a criminal and she should be in prison. And
I think that's a nice spot to leave it on. Thank you so much, Muad'Dib, for coming on the show with us today. Do you have a website there?
Yes, it's http://jforjustice.co.uk. And if you add a slash and a 77 to the end of that, you can watch the film on that website as well.
All right, thanks.
And the Friends of Muad'Dib website is http://mtrial.org. So all they right. can read up about everything. But what needs to happen, because I'm trying to get her into court and trying to expose her, they will do everything
unfortunately,
they can.
They will. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thanks very much for coming on. Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Join us in the chat room at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. There's actually quite a few people in there. I'm quite surprised. Welcome, guys. And also, we've got a fabulous guest on the line, our Kiwi collaborator for today, and I don't think we've had a Kiwi collaborator for a few days so far. His name is Brian Rearson, and he joins us now from Auckland, New Zealand, north of Auckland, of course, and he's basically an incredibly bright guy who's figured out, like many people, that the entire taxation system that we have in this country, and of course it's mirrored around the world, that's why it's a great fraud, because it works in several different languages, it's all just a fraud. Taxation is a fraud. Okay, let me say that one more time. Taxation is a fraud. Brian Rearson, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vinny.
I'd love it to just introduce yourself, just in the short segment that we have here. Your name, your website, and a little bit about yourself.
Right. I'm Brian. I'm a 65-year-old Kiwi. I've had a varied life. I once owned quite a large business, but I ended up my last little bit of career while I was driving a bus, which was quite interesting. I've currently retired, and really a couple of years ago I started becoming a little bit of an activist on the political scene. I wrote a letter to the Commerce Commission, basically pointing out the longest, what I regarded as the longest running scam in history, being the interest New Zealand was paying on overseas debt on money created out of thin air by the banksters of the world, led by, of course, the House of Rothschild. And for the last 2 years, I've been emailing MPs, writing letters to various newspapers, attempting to get what I believe the truth about these matters out. I have a website. A young man decided to get hold of all my stuff and put it on a website, and it's www.digitalwarfare.co.nz, which some of you might like to look at. And on that, you could email me on zerotaxnz@gmail.com if you want to get any of my stuff or want to contact me and disagree with me or whatever. My most recent thing, I've been sending by email and physically trying to put flyers in people's letterboxes. Maybe if I read my flyer to you, you can start to understand where I'm coming from. My flyer.
We'll get that. We'll get into this just after the break. My Friday. Very special guest, ladies and gentlemen, is Vinny. Brian Rearson, our Kiwi collaborator for today. And we'll be right back just after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you on American Freedom Radio Network. Back in a moment.
United we stand and divided we fall. Unity, please don't desert me.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Join us in the chat room there. And also, check out GorillaMedia.co.nz, where we have fabulous Kiwi activists posting articles daily so that you can be kept in touch with what's going on in our fabulous New World Order. Now, our very special guest is Brian Rearson from New Zealand, our Kiwi collaborator for today from Zero Tax New Zealand. Brian, welcome back.
Thank you, Vinny. Yeah, I was going to run through the flyer that I'm trying to get out to everybody so that they know who not to vote for when we have our election coming up.
Isn't that like an all-of-the-above box that you can check?
ZeroTaxNewZealand@gmail.com. And okay. I can send you a copy so everybody can send it to everybody in their inbox. Anyhow, it starts with a photo that I've found of some protesters in New York with a big yellow banner saying, "Why pay taxes when they can just print the money?" And of course, there's something wrong with that flyer because the governments don't print the money, the banksters do. Anyway, my flyer goes something like this. We can have zero taxation and 3% house mortgages for all New Zealanders. The government should own the banking system and the power of money creation, not the private banksters. We can have 3% housing loans on owner-occupied dwellings. Think about this. If the New Zealand government created our own currency internally instead of borrowing it from a private banking organisation that creates money out of thin air, then the government wouldn't need to tax us. New Zealand is a great trading nation. Our exports pay for all our imports. Our terms of trade are in balance. But we pay $20 billion per annum in debt servicing. The New Zealand banking system is controlled by JP Morgan, a Rothschild subsidiary, who set up the US Federal Reserve for the Rothschilds in 1910, passed into law on Christmas Eve 1913 when most senators were on holiday. JP Morgan is the largest share owner of infrastructure companies in Australasia. This includes a controlling interest in the big four Australian banks who dominate the New Zealand banking market. The big winners from the housing boom and the Working for Families tax credits have been the banksters. 90% of the New Zealand housing stock existed before the boom, most with relatively small mortgages. Now we are burdened with an extra $170 billion on these houses, debt on these houses. The Rothschilds banking cartel created this money out of thin air. Like the $35 trillion paid to the banks in quantitative easing and corporate bailouts worldwide, the money we borrow is created out of thin air by the money creation fractional reserve banking system controlled by the Rothschilds for more than 250 years. The New Zealand government created their own money supply to end the 1930s depression. They used this to build 33,766 houses and the roading network. This was only stopped when they were threatened with trade sanctions by their Bank of England, which was then a private bank owned by the Rothschilds. It is inherently evil for a private concern to have the power to create money instead of democratically elected responsible governments. And I go on to say more about the Rothschilds, how they control the news. They set up Reuters. Rupert Murdoch, for example, is a Zionist. Most billionaires in the world are Zionists. The billionaires in New Zealand almost exclusively are. Our rich, so-called richest man is. The three gentlemen that from small town New Zealand that went to Russia and came back billionaires have Zionist roots, and it goes on and on. So, one of the billionaires in New Zealand. A little bit more about the Zionists, probably. These Zionists periodically create depressions so they can buy more assets on the cheap and keep mankind enslaved. In New Zealand, we have a family that was funded by the Rothschilds and bought a house a week during the depression. They now own over 2,500 houses. But that is just in just one city. This was done in every major city in the world. Our own Prime Minister worked for the US Federal Reserve since 1999. When he was appointed to the New York Branch Foreign Exchange Committee. He has been packaged as our Prime Minister and is here to increase our indebtedness and sell off our assets such as Kiwi Bank. We have a bountiful planet with enough for everyone, and New Zealand especially is a bountiful country. The government that creates its own currency automatically has to live within its means externally, but can create great prosperity internally. Education can and should be free. Full employment should be the norm. People inherently want to lead productive lives and can if educated to the best of their ability. And I ended by saying you can find out much more about the true state of the world at our website, digitalwarfare.co.nz. Are you there, Vinny?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Is there anything you want to ask me?
Well, you know, the problem of Zionists, and I won't call it a Zionist phenomenon or anything. I'm just going to call them a problem because that's what they are. it's like some people kind of get confused and they say, oh, if you're anti-Zionist, that means you're anti-Semitic. And I said, well, no, actually most Semites aren't Zionists and most Zionists aren't Semites. In fact, most Jews aren't Semites either. And people don't know the difference between Jew, Semite and Zionist. Okay. It goes like this. Jewish is a religion, Semite is a race, and Zionist is a political persuasion. Okay, you know, we could classify them as, say, African American or a Christian or Republican. Okay, that's how different they really are, and people kind of tend to lump them all in the same category. Now, I got no problem with Semites, no problem with Jews. I do have a problem with Zionists, however, because they're the ones who think that anybody who doesn't go along with the idea of slaughtering people for no good reason, of course, and attempting to control the world via corrupt means is a grand idea, you know? That's basically my beef with them, you know? If you want to kill people and ruthlessly fraud the rest, I'm not happy with you. You know, I should think that was a pretty straightforward thing, but apparently our Prime Minister, John Key, wouldn't agree with me, particularly seeing as I've seen a photo of him at a Zionist meeting.
Right. Yeah, on that tack, Vinny, I like to quote Henry McCow, himself a Jew, from 2009. We have a false society. The central bankers, Rockefellers, Rothschilds, Warburgs, and the rich control the media, politicians, professors, journalists. Those who deviate from the script are quickly marginalized. Our social, political, and cultural life is a charade. Most people who are successful in the public realm are witting or unwitting collaborators. Evil rises to the top. This has ceased to be strictly a Jewish conspiracy. But like everyone else, Jews need to know about it or be manipulated and used forever. They need to know that anti-Semitism is caused by the outsized roles other Jews, half-Jews and crypto-Jews have played. Zionism is an instrument of world government. Henry McCow, 2009. We have a false society.
Mm-hmm.
If you deviate from the script, you are marginalised.
Yep.
Which Absolutely. Is why we can't get the truth from the media, why we are continually lied to.
Yeah. Well, it's the thing. If in order to create a false reality, essentially, you need to control the mechanisms by which people are capable of observing reality. And of course, probably the most effective mechanism of controlling people's observance of reality is television, radio. Yeah. All of these other forms of media, because those are the things that are essentially supposed to be the people's eyes and ears in the world around. And if those eyes and those ears are either plugged or blinded by Zionist conspiracy, then hey, you've got yourself a false reality. Nice.
Yeah. Are you aware of the two Swiss physicists that did a study of who owns what in the world? Particularly the backbone, what they call the backbone companies of each country's economy. I've got some stuff on that. Very interesting guys. A pair of physicists at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich did a physics-based analysis of the world of the economy as it looked in early 2007. Stefano Battiston and James Glatfelder extracted the information from a tangled yarn that links 25,000 stocks and 106,000 shareholdings in 48 countries, revealing what they called the backbone of each country's financial markets. These companies were the banks, the infrastructure companies, the water companies, electricity companies, and they found out the same few people owned virtually all of these 80. These backbones were the owners of 80% of each country's market capital, yet consisted of remarkably few shareholders. Anyhow, I wrote to them and I asked them who these people were in Australia and New Zealand, and you might be interested in the list. The largest share owner of these companies is JP Morgan Nominees Australia. In New Zealand, it's ANZ Nominees, Origin Energy Pacific Holdings, Barclays PLC, Her Majesty the Queen in Her Right of New Zealand, Nationwide News Limited, National Nominees Limited, Infratil, and Bank of New York Mellon Corporation. And these same entities seem to control the same type of companies throughout the world.
Well, so we're talking about infrastructure, information, and government, and money creation, all under the ownership of international banks. So when people say the international banks own and run the world, they're not just blowing it out of proportion and using a hyperbole. They're being quite frickin' literal.
Yes.
Well, that's nice to know.
Well, I guess you've got to identify the enemy so you can do something about them.
Well, I mean, you have to take ownership of the problem as opposed to just letting the problem take ownership of all your assets.
Yes, well, anyhow, that's basically where I'm coming from. Where I first started to doubt what I was hearing and what I was seeing from mainstream media was way back in 1963 when I saw live on television Lee Harvey Oswald assassinated by one Jacob Rubenstein, also known as Jack Ruby. Purely to stop him proclaiming his innocence. The real reason Kennedy was shot, of course, was because 3 months before his shooting, he passed Executive Order 11110, which was to ban the US Federal Reserve, and the government was to start printing its own money.
And that was closely followed by Presidential Directive 1111111 or whatever, abolishing the CIA.
Right, I didn't get that far.
It's just like
Vinny. Anyhow, from my reading, of course, the other main president that was assassinated that we know of was Lincoln. Lincoln's famous quote on banking was, "The government should create, issue, and circulate all the currency and credit needed to satisfy the spending power of the government and the buying power of consumers. The privilege of creating and issuing money is not only the supreme prerogative of the government, it is the government's greatest opportunity. By adoption of these principles, taxpayers will be saved immense sums of interest. Money will cease to be the master and become the servant of humanity."
Yeah, and that was, of course, at a time where the United States economy was exploding. It had 10% growth virtually every year for near on 100 years or so. No interest on the money supply, and incidentally, they didn't have any private central bank. But of course, that was at a 0% interest rate, mind you. And then, as soon as 1913. The old Federal Reserve, keeping it bankster since 1913, I always say, they introduced interest, and then, hey, massive fucking stock market crashes happened. And they were managed to buy up everybody's assets for pennies on the dollar for the crisis that they created, because they moved all their money into gold, of course, to retain its value, while they collapsed the currencies and the economies all around them, drove down the value and worth of everybody else's assets so they could buy them on the cheap. Isn't that a lovely scam? I thought it was quite fabulous.
Yeah, of course, that's what they do. That's why we have these depressions and financial calamities, so that they can buy more of the assets on the cheap.
It's just a systemic methodology as well, because you can apply that same principle across virtually any government organization or any what we call fiduciary position of authority, whether that be the law society or the medical establishment or the military or anything. They all create problems to which the solution is them having more power over other people.
Yes, well, just to remind everybody that I do have a website, digitalwarfare.co.nz, and I have an email address where I can send you stuff if you're interested. It's zerotaxnz@gmail.com. Right, anything else you want me to talk about, Vinny?
Well, I kind of wanted to know what actually got you into this sort of field in the first place, and we'll talk about this sort of after the break, Brian, because in my experience, anybody who winds up becoming an activist winds up facing persecution either before or after or during the process of becoming an activist and standing up for truth and humanity, and it's often some description of nasty event which galvanizes one into becoming an activist and actually caring about the consequences of what happens to your country, right? And you know, for me, it was being arrested by the police, as you do, and noticing the big lies and everything that they say and the manipulation of the court system in there. When you experience it firsthand, it makes you very, very upset. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest from New Zealand is Brian Rearson, and we'll be right back at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Yeah, yeah, and no one like me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Congratulations, you made it. Welcome to the Crusader. Been a long time coming, yo.
Yeah,
but I'm here now. What you wanna do? How many dudes you really know? Like this. Let's do it. How many dudes you know vote like this? How many dudes you know flow like this? Not many, if any. Not many, if any. How many dudes you know got skills to go and rock a show like this? I don't know anybody. Check.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Been a little bit hardcore. No, I'm just joking. I'm a nice little pussycat, innit? At the Vinnie Eastwood Show. com. You can check out our archive section with all the fabulous Kiwi collaborators that we have interviewed. More Kiwi activists than anybody else in the history of planet Earth. I can say that with authority. Yes, I can. Speaking of activists in New Zealand, we have one on the line here. His name is Brian Rearson. ZeroTaxNZ@gmail.com. If you want to email him, Brian, welcome back.
Yeah, Vinny. No, I've never been arrested or hassled by the cops, so I guess I'm a little bit lucky. But I really only started having a profile in October 2009 when I made the complaint to the Commerce Commission, copies of which I sent to the Commissioner of Police, the Victoria University Taxation Working Group, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the Serious Fraud Office, Chief of Staff of the Armed Forces, the Banking Ombudsman, the New Zealand Law Society, editors of all New Zealand daily newspapers. I enclosed the Money Masters DVDs to everybody too, and some of us supplied Money Masters to every MP in New Zealand and everybody in the press gallery. For what good it did us, I don't know, but at least we
something tells
to
me not a single one of them watched it. It's like, hey, look, parliamentarian, university educated journalist, here's something that'll actually make all your work that you've done your entire life obsolete because you've been living a effing lie.
Right.
Watch it, and they'll just be like, "Nah, I'm sorry, I don't want to waste my life away. I'd rather just continue to waste my life away."
But as I mentioned, the silencing of Lee Harvey Oswald probably when I was about 18, and then the official story coming out, and then that being completely disproved by the Zapruder film, which was embargoed for 25 years. I mean, all these things make you think, well, hell, are we being led by the nose and not told the truth about other things? And, then you see all the countries America's invaded since World War II, so-called peacekeeping and things like that, you see governments demonised by the media, and then we go, and the people that you should call patriots who are defending their country and trying to hold on to their resources are referred to as rebels and insurgents by our media. Well, I mean, any thinking person's got to say, is this George Orwell stuff? And yeah. I think it is.
Yeah,
And of course, the current thing we're getting is the Libya thing. Whereas I'm finding from sources within Libya that Gaddafi's not like he's being painted at all. As I understand it, there's very little poverty in the country. Everybody gets a share of the oil revenue. When you get married, you get $60,000 interest free, and another $10,000 interest free to buy a car. The $60,000 is to get you into accommodation. There's free medical, free education. Nurses are very well paid, for example, because they're considered to be essential. And then you start reading books like Edward Griffin's The Creature from Jekyll Island and John Preston's Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and you realise these outfits like the United Nations and the Bank of International Settlements and the International Monetary Fund aren't really what you've been led to believe. So that's my journey to getting here, Vinny. Unfortunately or fortunately, I haven't been hassled by the police as yet.
Oh, well, just wait a while.
Well, I'm sure I'm on people's list because, as I said, I've been emailing MPs and every editor in New Zealand. And with the MPs, I find that three or four of them will always reply for a while, and then it's like they're told, hey, we can't go down this line, and then you get nothing out of them anymore. So,
it's getting
a long, hard battle. And, of course, the average Kiwis, they don't want to know these things, unfortunately. They don't want their eyes open. They like their nice little life, and they like to believe that, hey, this is a pretty good country we live in, and, you know, our media's honest, and our politicians are honest, and they're trying to help us.
I'm sorry. Whenever anybody says the media's honest or the politicians are honest, I just got to crack up laughing. It's a reflex action.
Yes. They don't understand they're being brainwashed by the media.
Yeah.
And let's face it, Parliament gets bogged down in trivialities rather than attacking the big problems that will basically fix everything. We can have great prosperity in New Zealand, but instead we're going to have the austerity which they're trying to foist upon all nations. And on that, good luck to the Irish and the Icelandics that seem to be wanting to throw off the yoke of the banksters and saying no to these austerity measures and more bank loans. So, anything else you want to discuss with me, Vinny?
This is your platform, Brian. I mean, I should be asking you that question ultimately. Now, you've had some interactions with some very lovely scum that I've also ambushed with a camera, namely Peter Dunn. Could you tell us a little bit about Peter Scum? Oh, sorry, Peter Dunn. That was a Freudian
slip. Right. Well, before the election of John Key, Peter Dunn, who's I don't know whether he calls himself a Christian party, but he's basically
United Future.
Yeah, but it's a Christian sort of religious party, and he himself is very Christian, and I've got nothing against that, of course. But anyhow, he had supported Helen Clark's Labor government, and a month or two prior to the election, he said that he would be supporting John Key. And it obviously had discussions with John Key about, yeah, if I get my seat and we get a few people in there, we'll support you and help you be a minority government. So anyhow, when I heard this, I thought it incumbent upon me to email Peter Dunn. John Key was basically a currency trader. And it's, currency trading is parasitical. It's not a productive enterprise. for somebody to win in a currency trade, somebody else has to lose. So it's non-productive. And, I mean, these are the questions that have never been asked of John Key. You've got $50 million. What productive enterprise did you create, Mr. Key, to get that money? Anyhow, so I emailed Peter Dunn, and I'd been emailing with my staff, and on occasions I got replies, and actually I got a letter from Peter Dunn at one stage, but this ceased after this email, and in fact, from then on my emails had been blocked to him. I emailed Peter along these lines. I said, Jesus, through the currency traders, through the money changers out of the temple, and you are now going to put a money changer into Vogel House. And Vogel House, of course, the Prime Minister's residence. So I thought that was the height of hypocrisy. But
let me guess, he decided to turn the other cheek.
No, he didn't turn the other cheek. He sent me from the room.
Oh, no, he didn't bend over and reveal his two cheeks to you, did he?
No, mate. So, that was me and Peter Dunn. But anyhow, I hope it got into his conscience somewhere. Of course, he was never going to change his mind, which he should have if he was a man of principle.
Speaking of evil scumbags without principle, our Prime Minister John Key, what do you know much about his past?
Well, he joined Faye Ridgewhite, who were the kings of privatisation in New Zealand, and if you read on my website the history of the Rothschild family, the privatisation process is spearheaded by the Rothschilds. In New Zealand, things like the power companies, the water companies, local authorities, previously were run by boards, which we did elect, and basically they were older business people, and they worked for peanuts, and their sole object was to supply us with bones, power, water, good supply as cheap as possible. And with privatisation, of course, it's all now about how much money they can get us out of these things. So John Key worked for them. Of course, when things got too hot for Faye and Rich White, and they made their $1 billion each, they snuck out of the country and hid in Ireland, and basically passed their mantle to Graham Hart, who is another Zionist, and is now New Zealand's richest man. And he started by stealing the government printing office for less than asset value. Our Prime Minister at the time, David Longy, threatened not to sign the sale agreement because he knew it was far too cheap. But anyhow, getting back to John Key, he then, I think he went to work for Merrill Lynch or some other.
Yeah, it was Merrill Lynch, yeah.
He was the head derivatives trader,
represented on the board of the Federal Reserve.
That's
for two
right.
Years.
In 1999, he was appointed to the US Federal Reserve along with such fine, upstanding citizens as Robert Rubin. He's been groomed by the Zionists to be our Prime Minister, and you cannot say a word against him. He's actually a very personable man, but you know, that obviously groomed somebody that they could sell to the public. Although we had Rob Muldoon as Prime Minister at one stage for a long time, and you could hardly call him personable. But John Key is, I mean, in normal circumstances, he'd be a nice guy to have a drink with. He's very personable. But nobody's ever asked him to explain exactly how he got his $50 million. Now,
well, people have asked him, and he always looks at the floor and then looks up at the ceiling and goes, "Send me a letter."
Right.
Which he'll never reply to.
Yeah, so, and really, the press should ask these questions in a true and open society, but we know we haven't got that anymore. And
oh, yeah.
I mean, I've had a pretty good life. You know, I was the first of the baby boomers, and New Zealand was a great place to live in the 50s, 60s, and most of the 70s. It's not as good now, which is unfortunate. And really why I do these things is there's nothing in it for me, but I'd like my grandchildren to inherit a better world eventually. And a world where you can expect the media to give you the truth and all these corporations aren't there to enslave you. And I'm afraid that's what we've got. And it's very disappointing.
Yeah. Well, it's like, hey, we've got another rich white guy in control of the country, and I'm sure the Americans will really kind of resonate with this, because after all, you've only had one non-white guy who's rich running the country. But those guys rich anyway. Well, the goodness knows how many hundreds of millions of dollars that Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and all of these other globalist Rothschild-owned bankster scum decide that it's a grand idea to finance all these people that are really, really nice and personable and can read a teleprompter bloody well and know how to not answer a question while talking. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Brian Reeson, and we'll be right back after the break.
What is about is something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating. Ooh, yeah!
Welcome back, folks. Final segment of the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Check out our radio show archives there. And if you would like to support the show, support our great sponsors, including our brand new one, Dr. Len Horowitz and Sherry Kane, who we had on the show, have allowed us to become one of their Healthy World affiliates. And they have ridiculously awesome health products for you. Now, back to our fabulous guest, Brian Reeson. And I sort of wanted to get a little bit of a backgrounder on you. Now, you used to be a bus driver, yes? And what drives a bus driver to look into the financial instruments that control our country?
Well, it was really just a pre-retirement job, Vinny. Before that, as I said, I had quite a big business in the South Island. And which I sold, and I mucked around for a while doing various little things, and that was my last little job for 18 months. It was an eye-opener. Poor old bus drivers, very hard done by, underpaid, and most of them are on a treadmill, which they can't get off. Anyhow, what we've been talking about to our other listeners from other countries is New Zealand, but basically, you'll all have a variation on the theme in your own countries. On our website, which is digitalwarfare.co.nz, there is a interactive world map, which you click on each country, and it's a world debt map. It tells you how much each country's in debt, what their population is, and how much the debt is per man, woman, and child. And you can see from that map, every country in the world has a similar situation to what we've been talking about in New Zealand. The thing I'm trying to get across is we're being farmed like cattle. See, all this money going to the banksters from New Zealand, it's our hard work that supplies it. Our biggest expenses when we're working are taxation and housing. And housing, the biggest cost in housing, of course, is interest. So we're being bled dry as a country, and we're being bled dry as individuals. And I've tried to get the message across, I hope, that we've actually got a bountiful planet. The food grows, there's fish in the sea. Life should be much better for people. And I know life's pretty good in New Zealand for most people. But for all humanity, we have a bountiful planet. And if we can get rid of this Zionist monster that has enslaved us all and turned us all into cattle, we can make this a much better planet to live on. And I think it'll be an end of wars and things like that. I really think fixing this problem is the way to change the planet.
How do you propose to fix this problem, seeing as it's been in place for hundreds of years?
Well, we've got to... I'm trying to work on the 100 monkey principle. We've got to open people's minds to the truth. And I think it's happening, because we're getting these massive demonstrations in these countries that are being asked to go to under austerity and pay off all these international debts and foreign debts. And that's what people are really protesting against. They're protesting against the bankers. But our media's not going to show that, of course. They're going to show the protesters causing a fight or hitting a policeman or setting fire to something. They're not going to actually get there and say, hey, what are you guys protesting about? And, I mean, really, that's why I'm on the radio today and why I'm doing what I'm doing. Is I'm just trying to break through to people and say, hey, yeah, your life's not bad in New Zealand, but here's the truth. I mean, it's dreadful that John Key, being what he is and who he is, and we know what he is and who he represents, is probably the most popular Prime Minister in the history of New Zealand, according to the latest opinion polls. So, Vinnie, that's where I'm coming from, and, you know, as I said, I think it's the same for every country in the world. We're all indebted to these people, and we're being farmed like cattle. But taking away the hard work that we do, like with GST, income tax, and high interest rates, it's probably half an average man's take-home pay goes in these things. So, I mean, how much better off could we all be if we didn't have to pay these things?
Yeah. Well, and it's just not the one form of tax. It's like all the different forms of tax. I think in the United States, for example, there's something like 1,200 different types of tax. You know, land tax, paycheck tax, bathroom tax, brake tax, cigarette tax, alcohol tax, O'Barry tax, Bush tax. Goodness knows what.
Yeah. So. I'd like to thank everybody for listening to me carry on today, and hope I got through to some of you, and yeah, you know, you've been understanding what I'm trying to say and what I'm in my own little way trying to do. So how are we off the time, Vinny?
We are just about to wrap up. Thank you so much, Ryan, for coming on the show with us today, mate. It's been very nice.
Thank you, Vinny.
All right. Brian Rearson from digitalwarfare.co.nz, ladies and gentlemen. You can check out his website online, as if you can't check out websites anywhere else. thank you for enjoying another edition of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. You can catch up with the archives both at AmericanFreedomRadio.com and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. And I'd encourage you to visit the websites, tell people about them, click the I like buttons, watch my videos, do the whole kit and caboodle. Please help the show grow, and every single contribution makes up a great, great whole. And I'd like to thank the listeners very much for all their support in this show, and to help this fabulous little, Vinnie Eastwood show keep on trucking, because I'm actually just kind of really having a lot of fun. Isn't that great? Thanks very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you again tomorrow.